Yes, hello everyone and happy holidays. Welcome back to the None But the Brave podcast. I am Hal Schwartz, and as always, I'm here with my great buddy, Flynn McClain. Flynn, how was Christmas?
Christmas was great. My wife cooked up a storm, and I ate really well. and that about sums it up.
Well, unfortunately, not many places to go this year on Christmas. Well, can't see family, but hopefully next year.
Next year, yeah.
You did get a little present from Mr. Springsteen.
Yes, we did. On Thursday, he released the November 7th, 2009 show from The Garden. The first time he ever performed The Wild, The Innocent, and The E Street Shuffle in its entirety. And it was quite the performance. I had to miss that one, but you were there.
Yeah, I sure was. And this night gets a little overlooked in history because of what happened the next night with The River. But this was one damn good show. And the performance of the record was phenomenal. The last 30 minutes of Incident, Rosie, Serenade was about just perhaps the best 30 minutes of music I've ever seen.
I can definitely see that. And he had the extra horns on stage and he had the string section. There was just no way I guess he has topped it, but that really set the bar quite high.
Well, he may have topped it with other things. I don't believe there's been a performance of New York City Serenade in particular better than was performed on this night, November the 7th, 2009. When the strings kick in, it is just such a goosebump moment, and it was that night. The whole, by the time he got through the record, we knew we were seeing something special. Now, I think some people are going to argue, and properly so, that the start of the show and the post-album portion wasn't quite as good as the next night, and that's definitely the case. Of course, The River took up much more real estate in the show than The Wild and The Innocent did, but this was a big-time performance, and everyone came through, all those guest musicians on stage.
Yeah, they were prepared. They came out. They did a tremendous job, and you can hear it. You can really hear it in this recording, and I'm just blown away. Yeah, I mean, we've had this great IEM recording from, I guess it was from Crystal Cat for years, but, you know, even that really doesn't do the show justice like this recording does.
Yeah, it's a great listen, and we should talk about that because Brad Serling had said on E Street Radio a couple of years back they wanted to release the show and they had a problem with the drives. Now, we're fortunate because they obviously solved that problem, although they didn't seem to have solved it completely because they did use a two-track line feed from the board to patch Lonesome Day and The Rising.
Right. We don't know exactly how much was missing when back in 2017 when Serling said that. So, and maybe they were just very hesitant about putting, even patching just as little as those, 4 or 5 minutes of Lonesome Day and The Rising from an inferior recording, but it worked well and no complaints here.
Oh, totally no complaints. And they have done patches before. There was a smaller patch on the 93 Hungerthon benefit that was released. I know there were several songs on one of the No Nuke shows were patched in from an alternate source. And also London 81 has at least part of a song that's patched from another source, right?
Yeah, and I guess we don't know how much they were missing when Brad Serling made his comments in 2017. Well, of course, at that time they hadn't released many shows with extensive patching. So, you know, maybe their opinions or attitudes have changed.
Perhaps, and it's the right call. I mean, this is a show that needed to be out there. It because of the landmark nature of the Wild and the Innocent performance. And the other thing we should point out, and he was very good on this evening, of course, Clarence is part of the band still at this point, which differentiates it from the recording from Australia. It was Brisbane, right, where they did Wild and the Innocent in 2014?
I believe so.
Yeah. And they also did, they did Side B in Rome in 2013, but obviously, that's post-Clarence. So this is the one chance we have to get this entire record with Clarence on the stage. And as an added bonus, he was very, very good that night.
Yes, he was. He really brought something extra to Rosie and Kitty's back. And, you know, he was on. He brought his A game for the big room.
Man, that Serenade, I remember when those notes faded out at the end, and you hear it on the archive, the arena erupted. Everyone knew that they had just seen something so it was really so special, and the emotion on Bruce's face that they had pulled it off. It was a great night. And again, you know, the next night was one of the best nights I've ever seen. I think a lot of people who were there share that. I wouldn't put this on the same level, but this again was a very, very special show.
Well, if you want to talk about an audience reaction, listen to the audience, the anticipation that rises up during the last few notes of Incident. Oh. And then when he finally, you know, rams or crashes into the Rosalita guitar intro, you hear the crowd just go nuts.
Oh, I was going out of my mind. I'm not going to lie. You know, that was the first time I ever saw Incident in Tarosi. And obviously we knew it was coming. Maybe on another night where it might have happened, you know, we wouldn't have known it was coming, but here we did know it was coming. And that created a buildup, not just for me, for the entire building, that, as you noted, when it crashed into Rosie, it was sort of a release. Yes. And the building just went bonkers.
Well, that's what that is. That's the tension of Incident into the release of Rosie. That's one of the reasons his shows have always been so great, and albums for that matter.
Now, one of the things that occurs is because that happened in the middle of the show, I know some people do knock the second half of the show. First of all, the performance of, say, Human Touch was truly magnificent. Oh. And there was a lot of good stuff in there, the Elvis Costello appearance. But yes, the show peaked after Incident Rosie and New York City Serenade. I don't know how a show wouldn't peak after that.
Well, it just makes the step off from Serenade to Sunny Day even more noticeable. But
yeah, well, but I guess let's not go there.
I guess the audience had some fun. And you're right, that performance of Human Touch is tremendous. It's always been my favorite one, or one of my favorites from the E Street Band, going back to, as I said, the Crystal Cat bootleg. And so to hear everything, as I said, just every little instrument, every little note, every guitar noodle, it's just wow. It just blows me away.
Yeah, nice Christmas gift from Bruce for sure for all of the fans.
Yes. Yes, sir.
Now, moving on to tonight's topic, as promised, we're talking about the 40th anniversary of the famed Nassau Coliseum stand that concluded with the Wild New Year's Eve show. And to reminisce with us, we have a couple of guests tonight, and Flynn is going to introduce the first one.
All right. First up is a longtime friend of the podcast, or as longtime friend as our podcast can have, Stan Goldstein. Author of the, or co-author of the Rock and Roll Tour of the Jersey Shore book, as well as actual tour guide for said tour. And so welcome back to the podcast, Dan.
Thank you, Flynn. Thank you, Hal. Thank you for having me on. Looking forward to talking about the Nassau Coliseum 40 years ago.
God, so lucky that you were at all these shows.
Yeah, you were attended all three, right?
I did. And I have no recollection except for the New Year's Eve show. I remember getting those tickets. It was all mail order for these shows. And for those who don't know what mail order is, you set the, like, there'd be an ad in the Sunday New York Times. You have to cut it out, mail it in with a money order. I don't even know if they let you choose which show, and you just had to wait and be patient and see if you either got tickets or you got your money order back saying, nope, no tickets for you. So quite different than what we have now.
To set the stage for the Nassau Coliseum shows, Bruce had just played four shows at the Madison Square Garden in New York City on Thanksgiving weekend and then again in mid-December. So in a span of about 5 weeks, he was going to play seven shows, basically within, what, a 20-mile radius, right?
Yeah.
So coming out of the Garden shows and going into Nassau Coliseum, were they regarded as just another three shows, or did you guys already kind of know it was going to be something special?
Well, you knew it'd be special because number one, the Garden tickets were like nearly impossible to get. Those were all mail order too. And he did two at the end of November, one on a Thanksgiving night, and then two, I believe it was the 17th and 18th of December. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky to get the tickets to Thanksgiving night. And so when you saw the three shows at the Nassau Coliseum, you were like, wow, this is going to be, and of course, a New Year's Eve show. So that was like the hot ticket, like, all right, Bruce on New Year's Eve, that's where I want to be on Uniondale, Long Island, you know, stuff. But no, it was quite special. And for me personally, I was at the time in my junior year at St. John's University in Queens. So this was, you know, right after finals too. We were on Christmas break. And so it was a real relaxing time. So to be able to go to three shows with Bruce during that period was like the ultimate.
Oh, sounds like that was such an amazing week. And speaking of which, there have long been stories that that week was brutally cold. What do you remember about that?
Yes, I do remember that. It was freezing out. And I'll give you a little story after the December 29th show. I was there with Billy Smith, who's a big Bruce fan, lives in Florida now. And Billy, after the show, knew some of the people on the road crew. And he was able to get a backstage pass, but he only got one. So I said to him, you go ahead. I'll go out in the car. And I remember sitting in the car, even with the engine running, and it was so cold. And after about 45 minutes, Billy comes back. Oh, it was great. I met Billy Joel backstage and had a lot of fun. But yeah, it was a very cold week that time.
So set the stage, December 28th, 1980. There's been the four shows at the Garden, as Flynn mentioned. And now Bruce is taking the stage at the Coliseum, and he opens with a tour debut, and I think the first time he'd played it ever, right? Of Merry Christmas, Baby.
Yeah. I actually, before I came on with you two, I went back and did a little research, and I, at the time, don't even think I was familiar with the song. I didn't know if it was a Bruce original at the time. Now, you know, doing research, I see it goes back to 1947. But that was a shocker just to hear that, and probably the first time I ever heard it, but that was pretty wild.
And I mean, perfectly setting the tone really for the stand, because it was the week between Christmas and New Year's. They were going to end with this big blowout New Year's Eve show. And here he is on stage. And of course, he was already known at that point for doing Santa Claus. And here's another Santa song opening the stand.
Right. And the thing, I don't know if many people remember the first show, December 28th, Flo and Eddie came out and sang backup vocals on Hungry Heart. They were on the record, of course. And Flynn and Hal, you may know better than me. I don't know if they ever did it any other time that they came out and did the backup vocals on Hungry Heart there.
I think they have. Don't quote me on that, but I think they have. But I couldn't tell you which shows they did it for. But that was the version that ended up on Live 75-85, yeah. Right?
Right.
Yeah. So they took advantage of the guest spot, and of course they had the multi-track trucks out there, recording it for all of posterity.
Now, Stan, coming off the Darkness tour, of course, Bruce had already broken out. And then here on the River tour, things were starting to ratchet up in a big way. He had his first hit single with Hungry Heart. He was now doing seven shows, as we mentioned, in the area. He had done the four shows at the Garden. What was the feel like in the crowd? Did people acknowledge that this guy was becoming a megastar in front of their eyes?
Well, for me, he was a megastar back in 1977-78. But I think that really occurred with the craziness of getting tickets to the four Madison Square Garden shows. And you two may be too young to remember this. there was a big scandal with the tickets at Madison Square Garden that the scalpers bribed a lot of the people in the Garden box office. That's how hot of a ticket it was. And the New York State Attorney General had to investigate it because, you know, as you were saying, how Bruce, was this huge superstar now. And these were really, really hot tickets. And for the Nassau Coliseum stand, too, it was just, it was just a festive week, the festive three nights, as I said, between Christmas and New Year's. And, Bruce was on top of the world, and you felt it.
Since you went back to the mid-70s, as a fan, how different did it feel to you being in the arena? There were obviously a lot of new fans, as you just noted, the demand had gone way up. Did you sense a difference in whether it was in the performance or how the crowd felt?
Just that he kept getting better and better. He was improving. You know, to us, I grew up on the Jersey Shore. I grew up in Neptune, which is the town next to Asbury Park. And to us, he was always our big superstar. But it really was to see, you know, just the whole crowd being into him so much. It was like you just saw how he mastered the crowd, how he really was on top of his game. And I think you hear on the 1229 and the 1231 archive releases, just they're really firing on all cylinders at these shows. They were a fine-tuned machine.
So he basically had the audience in the palm of his hands. Is that an accurate statement?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, and, so go on.
Now, I was going to say, looking back, I see it was the first time he ever played This Land Is Your Land.
That's where I was going.
Okay. And though he did it all three nights. And that was like, he made a little bit of political statements too. And that was, I believe, the first time he really did something like that, or one of the first times. So it also, in addition to being, you know, rock and roll, it was also like we were hearing a bit about Bruce, you know, about social issues and things like that for the first time.
And what was the crowd's reaction to his This Land Is Your Land introductions? When he was talking about this is your country, this is your time, you got to go out and you got to get it yourself, protect it for yourself. What kind of reaction did the audience have?
Oh, they were respectful listening to him. There was no Brucing or anything like that, which goes back to the command of the crowd he had. And people listened to what Bruce said. And one thing I remember about the song, though, the thing that got the loudest cheer was in the New York Island part of it. And every night, and you can probably hear it on the Nugs releases, too, the crowd just went nuts. But no, they listened to him. I listened to him. And I remember as I was 20 years old at the time, thinking like, okay, what is he trying to teach me? What don't I know that he's trying to get over to me?
Well, and it's interesting because he was having an awakening himself. And of course, this would culminate later in the tour with the Vietnam Veteran Show, which we've already talked about. And I think that Bruce himself, he felt like internally, like he needed to say something that perhaps was a little bit more important, we'll say, we'll use important in air quotes, than he had been doing just playing rock and roll the previous number of years. Would you say that's fair?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and, you know, I think he said he had read a book that John Landau had given him called The History of the United States. I don't know if he mentioned it at these shows. I think he may have one night. And, it was, you know, it was a little bit about Bruce, like, you know, take a look around you and know what's going on and be aware of what's going on.
But it's going back and listening to those introductions now, he seemed pretty vague about things. He wasn't talking about specific issues. He was just talking about making sure that people can establish themselves and they're not forced out of their community. Unlike, obviously, later on, we talk about the Vietnam vets being a very specific issue, as well as the food banks, basically throughout the rest of his career.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's what I was saying. It was the first time he really, that I remember, that he brought, you know, started talking about something like that. So maybe he was still getting his feet wet, too, about what he really wanted to say and come across. And also you asked, you know, how the crowd reacted, that, you know, the crowd shut up and listened to him and wanted to hear what he had to say about these things.
All right. So different than at the Garden shows in 2016, when as soon as Independence Day started, you could hear this din of conversation going across the entire arena. And that was very disappointing. So I always like to wonder what it was like at the time.
Oh, we know modern day audiences have shorter attention spans and certainly more distractions with stuff like cell phones.
Yeah, that's so true. But getting back to the shows, Stan, what do you remember about the band's performances that week?
I just remember they were really tight. They were playing them real well. I know at the Garden for that Thanksgiving show, I didn't have great seats. I was far away. So, you know, it's tough at the Garden, especially if you're on the other side of the arena and up in the old green seats, as they said. And here at Nassau, I was a bit closer. So you just got this feeling that, you know, I could see Bruce, you know, as always, though, but he just really had the command over the band, over the audience. And they were playing well. They were really tight. You hear it on the Nugs releases, too.
Would you say that in the entire time and the many times you've seen Bruce, is this stand really the peak? I mean, obviously, he's played amazing shows in the 40 years since, not to take anything away from those shows. But the River Tour is probably the peak of his career. And at least listening to the New Year's Eve show, one could make the argument that that was the ultimate peak that he ever hit as a live performer. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I can agree with that. Although for me, and I know many wouldn't agree with me on this, I always felt the peak was the 10-night stand at the Meadowlands in August of 1984. I just felt, you know, he was on top of the world with Born in the USA and the crowd was with him. But there's no arguing about how he was at the peak here, too, what you could say. They, like I said, they were just on top of the world, and they were tight. They were playing well, and it was like, you know, you knew they were just headed to where 1984 was going to be, that they were going to be the biggest thing in the world.
Are there any specific songs or performances from these nights that you still think back and are like, holy crap, that was amazing?
Yeah. I'll tell you a story about the second show, December 29th. Again, that was the night it was with Billy Smith. We were about three rows behind the stage behind Clarence. And we stuck a tape recorder in and recorded it. Yeah, at the time. We were watching security where they were checking people. So Billy stuck the tape recorder down in his crotch and made it in. And we recorded it. I had a great, great recording for a long time of it. Anyway, he opened that night with Night. And that was pretty rare at the time. He hadn't played it. It was a tour premiere. And on the tape, you can hear Billy and I going, Night! Oh, my God! We were so excited. And, you know, the thing is, again, pre-internet days, we didn't really realize how rare it was. But we were just so excited to hear it. And the other thing that night, he played Incident into Rosalita, which was the last time he did that until, Des Moines, Iowa, how? In 2009, 2008?
Yeah, it was the last performance of Incident at all until the famous Spectrum, well, not the Spectrum, the Philly performance at the First Union Center, whatever they call that place. It's gone through a number of names on September 25th, 1999, also an archive release. And, of course, that version of Incident has been out for a long time because they used it for the Live 75, 85 B-side, although there was kind of bastardized because they took it out and made it feel like a club. And, of course, on the archive release, it's restored in its full glory. But just what a remarkable performance to listen to. That is the 1229 show, and I've always said this, and I think we talked about it when it came out on the show. That is, in my opinion, now, of course, I wasn't there. I was 10 minutes away, unfortunately, but 10 minutes, as I said in the last episode, 10 minutes away, but about 10,000 miles. But what a performance on 1229, almost to the equal, if not the equal, of 1231 listening to it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think even now we know in multiple night stands, usually the opening night is not usually the best show. Not that there's anything wrong with it. But it's not the show that you look back on at three, four nights at the same place and go, oh, that was the best one of the four. And, you know, the first one in Nassau, December 28th, I think they were just getting their feet wet a little bit. And then, the 29th was just boom. And that really set up for New Year's Eve.
Well, were you expecting Rosie out of Incident on that night?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yes, we were. We were.
So you were ready for that and for the powerful guitar to kick in.
Absolutely. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. We would have been very, very disappointed if he didn't. But also it was at the end of the show too. So you knew he always closed the shows with Rosalita before the encore. So you figured that was coming.
Okay. Now another three song combination I want to ask about, at least from the first two shows, was the Stolen Car, Wreck on the Highway, Point Blank.
Yeah.
A trio. Being it's different, well, obviously, now listening to it 40 years later, but how was it at the time? Do you have any recollections of your reactions or the fan reactions around you?
Yeah, you know, that came, I'm just looking at Bruce's face here, and that came after like For You, which is, you know, a bit of a rocking song, and then he went into those three songs. And that was, you know, powerful is the way to describe it. I remember in Wreck on the Highway, they had like a eerie light showing, like on the stage, like a green spotlight or something, where it was almost like Bruce was staring into it, like he was looking at the wreck on the highway. And I remember that being real powerful. And I believe they did that every night when he played that song. And, it's just something fitting, like, you know, he was looking at the wreck on the highway. And then, of course, Point Blank, always great, still great to this day. But, looking back, that was quite the triple header. I love Stolen Car. And I know we're jumping ahead a little bit, but he didn't play that New Year's Eve, but we got it on the 29th.
And the 28th.
And the 28th, yes.
Right. Well, of course, the great thing about Bruce's sets is the way he builds the tension and then he sets the release. And obviously, there's no greater tension than Stolen Car, Wreck on the Highway, Point Blank. And then you have the release in Tyzerbine, Ramrod, you can look.
Yeah.
And I mean that was just part of his legend. I remember, was it what's his name? Was it Patrick Humphreys or Chris Hunt in their book Blinded by the Light? Talked about how he takes you up and he brings you down and he takes you back up even higher than you were before. And that just, of course, built the legend.
Mm. Doesn't he still do that in a
way? He totally does.
Of course he still does, but that's what, you know, that his ability to do that really, I mean, that built the legend in 1980.
Pure genius, though. Flynn is right. I mean, to follow Stolen Car, Wreck on the Highway, point blank with The Ties That Bind is just, it's just stunning. And Flynn is right. I mean, that's one of the genius things that he's done and why his live performances are so compelling, because he's taking you through these various feelings. And, you know, again, I think probably the River Tour, the original River Tour, I should say, now that there's been a second one, is probably the high point on that. And he had such a diverse group of material in 1980-81.
You know, there was something I was thinking, how he done most of the songs from the River, and I was looking back at the set list and I'm like, no, he did quite a few of them, but he didn't do a lot of them either. And she said we're very diverse, a lot of Darkness songs and some early songs, really mixed up the set list.
And For You, that's he wasn't doing songs from the first two albums, like, well, I guess except for Spirit and Rosie, too much at that point,
right.
And I guess Sandy was kind of a regular at that point, though.
Yeah.
I got to go back and look at the four Garden sets, which I haven't really refreshed my memory on in a while. Stan, were these sets a lot different than what you had seen at the Garden on Thanksgiving night?
I'm going to have to look on that. I have Bruce face up as we're talking. Well, he opened with Born to Run.
Right. He did not do that at the Coliseum.
Yeah, right, which was interesting. And just a quick look, I see Jackson Cage was played the night I was there. But yeah, some of it was still the same. He did the Stolen Car, Wreck on the Highway, Point Blank trio, Into Ties That Bind, Ramrod, and Backstreets. So yeah, a little bit of the same arc, but throwing some different songs in here and there.
Yeah, looking back on it, it's interesting that Jackson Cage did not make a single appearance over these three nights.
No, not at all.
And that was pretty much a regular up through the Garden there.
Yeah. Well, he was bringing in some new stuff right around that time. Who'll Stop the Rain had come into the set. We mentioned This Land Is Your Land. I think also Who'll Stop the Rain aims at what we were talking about, this political awakening. I mean, it's certainly a song that has a political theme to it. And of course, it became a very key moment at opening the Vet Show the following August.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm glad you brought that up, because we did get to hear that all three nights. And I'm not quite sure how much Bruce had been playing that before the three Nassau shows. I see it was on a tour debut. But
it was premiered two shows earlier at the Garden, 12/18.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So he put that in the set list. So that was a bit different than, like I said, I only saw one of the Garden shows, but to have that. So here you had that, and you also had This Land Is Your Land in it, too.
And he actually played those two back to back on New Year's Eve, making for a heck of a statement.
Yes, he did. Into the Promised Land.
Yes, that's what I was going to point out. Let's not forget that it was then led into the Promised Land, which, as we know with that song and where it's placed, that's never an accident. And Who'll Stop the Rain, This Land Is Your Land, The Promised Land, that's a trifecta for you.
Yeah, very, very true.
So, Stan, moving to New Year's Eve, this was obviously a very big night. Everyone knew it was going to be a big night. You look at the shows that are famous in his career. You got The Bottom Line, of course. You've got The Agora. You've got Winterland. The second Hammersmith show. And then you've got New Year's Eve. Those are probably the biggest shows of his career that we just named right there. How did you feel in the building that night as the show was unfolding and really as midnight was approaching, pretty crazy stuff was going on?
It was electric. It was magical. I'll tell you the truth. One thing I remember is when right after midnight, I don't know. For some reason, I thought he was going to go to 2 a.m. or something like that. Like, since it was New Year's Eve, he was just going to keep going, that we were going to get one of those 4.5, 5-hour shows that everyone talks about but never really happened.
Dan, he played 38 songs.
He did. He did. But I remember once after New Year's, after playing Auld Lang Syne, he went right into Rosalita. And I always knew that was the final song of the main set. And me being 20 years old and kind of naive, I was like, oh, okay. The encore's going to start soon. I don't know. Even though, like you said, it was 38 songs and quite long. I thought we were still going to get another 2 hours or so. Well,
this was the longest show for years and years and years until he went crazy and started doing the 4-hour shows in 2016, no?
2012.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you're correct, 2012, and I should know that because the second Paris show was so long, and then he did break the 4-hour mark in Helsinki. But that was one show, and then in 2016 we had that run of shows where he played basically 4 hours a night, which was pretty crazy.
That was very crazy. But, yeah, he was – I guess even with the breaks, New Year's Eve was – I mean, it must have been over 4 hours with the break, no, Stan?
Yeah, I would think so, and close to it. Oh, with the break, including the break, absolutely. And I know we got out of there. It was probably 1:15 or so. So it was still pretty long, 38 songs.
Well, the archive clocks in at 3 hours and 43 minutes.
Wow.
But that does not include the intermission break, which was at least 15 minutes.
Yes. Right. Oh, I'm sure. It probably ran a little bit longer.
Yeah, right. Probably closer to 30.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the big thing that night too, and you hear this on the Nugs release, is the big concern was fireworks. We know what happened to Bruce at the Richfield Coliseum on New Year's Eve 1978. And there was this big concern that you don't see this anymore now, but there was this big concern that people were going to throw fireworks at right at midnight. And Bruce makes an announcement about 20 minutes before midnight to please not do it. And I do remember when it hit midnight, all the house lights went on, just like it does during Born to Run now. And I think it was not only celebrate New Year's, but it was also like, if anyone's throwing fireworks, we're going to see who you are.
that's cool. I had not heard that story before.
Mm.
Now, there was a 3-song combination in this show as well, songs that would be played a few more times, I think, on the River Tour, but then not for a long time after that. Tell us what you remember of Rendezvous, Fade Away, The Price You Pay, All in a Row.
That was pretty wild. You know, I always liked Rendezvous, so he's always glad to hear that because, you know, I believe he was doing that as early as 1976. And I guess through the magic of bootlegging, I was aware of it. And Fade Away, you know, I don't think it was out at the time, but that was the second single, which I don't know if it was released at this time, which I always thought was an interesting choice after Hungry Heart. And
it did go to top 20.
It did, yeah.
But it did likely kill the momentum of the record. I mean, clearly there were other songs on there. Cadillac Ranch comes to mind.
Yeah.
Sherry Darling, Out in the Street. I mean, a very odd choice for a second single, I would say. And I like the song, but just not that radio friendly.
Fade Away is one of those songs that I have grown to appreciate more over the years. I don't think I really cared for it at the time. Was like, you know, as a 20-year-old going, oh, this is a boring song. But Price You Pay, I always loved. I always, that was always special. There was just something special about that. And it still is to this day. It was so rare that he didn't play it for a long time. But that was quite the freestyle. And then that went into Wreck on the Highway, too, that night.
Even back then, he didn't play The Price You Pay that regularly on the River Tour, did he?
Flynn, you might know better than me. I don't believe so.
It was a semi-regular, through the spring before he went to Europe. I mean, it wasn't an every nighter, but it wasn't, you know, once every 10 shows either.
Now, and it is interesting because Bruce Bass says that the Rendezvous was the last performance of the song until 1999.
Wow.
Well, something about it being included on Tracks. And then that's the version that is actually on Tracks that got it back onto his radar.
Mm.
That makes total sense.
And when do you want to talk about the real rare one we got that night?
Well, what did you know about that one, Held Up Without a Gun?
I knew it because it was the flip of Hungry Heart, the 45, and just knew it was, well, how long is it? A minute and 30, a minute and 40?
Something like that, yeah.
It's very brief.
You know, so I was kind of, you know, I remember this and listening to, again, to the audio of the show. I remember after You Can Look But You Better Not Touch, Bruce was a little confused about how much time he had to midnight. And you can hear it. He goes, how much we got? 8 minutes? 6 minutes? 5 minutes? So it was like, all right, I better not do a long song. So he was like, he pulled it. What do you say? I'm pulling him, really pulling him out of the pit right now. And we got held up without a gun, which I was aware of. I don't know how many in the crowd did, but I thought that was real cool. And I looked in. I mean, that's only been played 5 times total. That was the first time, obviously.
And that was that was the debut, and then it wasn't played at all and for until 2008. So
right, Magic Tour. Open. And I was going to ask you, Flynn and Hal, do you know that's over 27 years? Has there been another song with that long of a break?
You know, that's always, and we've talked about this a lot. There were so many songs that took long breaks. That may be the longest one. We'd have to go back and check. How long was the... Was the Kitties Back? No, that would have been 78 to 2000. So that's only 22 years.
Only.
Yeah. This one was held up without a gun. And this was cheating. I looked it up on Bruce Space. Was after this New Year's Eve show was not played again until June 21st, 2008 in Hamburg, of all places.
Over in Germany. Well, yeah. And so you said that you knew it, but... What kind of reaction did it have with the rest of the crowd?
You know, at the time, it was 5 minutes to midnight. So I think the crowd was all hyped up anyway, getting ready for New Year's Eve. And so they were excited. They may not have known it, but they were still well into it, you know. And, as you brought up earlier about like a song Independence Day, and there's a lot of talking now. You know, Bruce, we were all younger then, so we were kids, you know, 20s, 25, you know, maybe the oldest person at the show was 30 or something like that.
That's so you funny know. To think so, about.
So everybody was so into the music then, you know, you didn't have cell phones, you weren't chatting away, you were totally into the show, they were well into it, and I think I was with some Bruce fans, and they were like, they knew it too, so, and... You know, I don't even know if we knew at the time he had never played it before, but it was pretty special. We were like, all right, he's trying to stall a bit because he doesn't know what time it is to midnight. And then then we got in the midnight hour.
And then obviously into Auld Lang Syne for New Year's. Mm. One of the few things that my wife remembers from that show, and she was there, was Bruce, it was all the girlfriends and wives being on stage at midnight. What are your memories from that?
I remember that. I remember coming out. I didn't know who Joyce Heiser was at the time, but she was one of the people who came out. I think there's video of it too. Not great video, but there is video, and you can see it. They were throwing confetti up and everything, but I do remember that all the wives and girlfriends did come out and gave a kiss and hug to the people on stage, and then they went and ran into it. So, you know, it was special for everyone.
So this show did have a couple of extra songs in the encores, Twist and Shout and Raise Your Hand, that he did Twist and Shout quite a bit on the river, but Raise Your Hand, not so much. So when you walked out at 1:15, as you said, were you saying to yourself, wow, we just saw one for the ages? Or were you just like, that was a great show?
No, knew you saw one for the ages. Absolutely. Okay.
All right. I've always wondered about that.
No. You knew it was special. Like I said earlier, there was the greedy me who figured he might go to 2 a.m. But looking out, and I didn't even realize it was 38 songs at the time. And but walking out, you knew, like, that's one I'm going to be talking about for years. And 40 years later, it's still one that, you know.
Well, we're talking about it.
Yeah, one of the more famous shows that he's played, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Has he ever done more than 38 songs in a show?
We'd have to go back and calculate. I don't think so, because probably even the long shows in 2012 and 2016, those shows got to be that length because certain songs were very elongated, stuff like that. So, you know, I don't think here you had a lot of short songs in the show. I don't think he's ever hit 38 songs, but we'll have to go back and take a look at that.
Yeah, I think Hal's right. I think a lot of the 4 hours was kind of padded by, you know, by false endings and yes, crowd sing-alongs. You know, I mean, I guess he did Twist and Shout on New Year's Eve, but, you know, a 10-minute version of Twist and Shout in 2012 and 16 was, well, I guess not 16, but 12 was definitely not unheard of.
Right. So, Stan, I'm just curious, with obviously you knew Walking Out, you just said it was a very special night. You've seen so many shows over the years. Where does this one rank overall as you look back?
It's top five. Don't ask me what my top five is right now, because I'd have to look at it again. But, oh, it's definitely up there. It's definitely was special. And, you know, the thing, too, he's never played another New Year's Eve show.
No, yeah, he hasn't. And that was after he played one in 75 and 78.
78. And you know what else I found interesting is he has never played in between with the E Street Band or any other tours. I think after December 17th or 18th and till the beginning of the new year. So this was the last time he ever definitely played between Christmas and New Year's. He did shows.
Yeah, but I never knew if it was legend or what, because, of course, by 1984, I was old enough to go to the shows, and I lived 10 minutes from the Coliseum. And there was all this talk in the fall of 84 that they were going to do New Year's Eve shows again at the Coliseum. And, of course, it never came to fruition. It was probably just random rumor that we heard as I was at that point, I was 15, 16 years old, depending on what point we're talking about in 84. So I don't know how much truth there was to it, but everyone was so hopeful he was going to do it again. It didn't happen in 84. And of course, as you just pointed out, it has never happened again. And unfortunately, I guess my guess is it's probably that's the end of it. This was the last New Year's Eve show.
Yeah, I remember, I think it was on the reunion tour in 1999, there was an article in the paper about the Meadowlands Arena, and they were quoted saying they weren't, because, you know, that was the new millennium and everything, and they were asking if they were going to have a New Year's Eve show, and they said, we have the date open, but only for one band, and as far as we know right now, they're not interested in doing it. So I guess the Meadowlands was hoping Bruce would do his show New Year's Eve 1999, but that never materialized.
Well, and also the thing about Nassau Coliseum, is, especially in 84, is that he was the biggest rock act on the planet at that point. And the Nassau Coliseum is actually relatively small for an arena, right?
Well, at the time, it held
12,000 or something?
No. At the time, it held about 16,250.
Oh, really? I thought it was like a lot smaller. Okay.
No. When the Islanders played there, and all the major acts played there, mm-hmm. I saw U2 played there on the Joshua Tree tour for two shows when they were the biggest band on the planet at that point. They actually opened the fall leg at the Coliseum. So, yeah, no, they downsized it after the Coliseum closed down and the Islanders left to go to Barclays. But when the Islanders were playing there, it was a 16,000-seat arena.
Okay. All right. My bad. My apologies. But that's still smaller than the Garden.
Oh, yeah.
In most other arenas, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was a great place to see a show. I mean, obviously for me, it was where I grew up. So very fond memories. And I've only seen Bruce there the one time that I was there on the Magic Tour with you guys. And to this day, I wish I had been at these shows in 1980, but, you know, understandably, my parents were not letting 12-year-old Hal go to rock concerts on New Year's Eve. And I don't think I would have gotten tickets even if they had said, okay, you can go.
What you mentioned, how I felt after the New Year's Eve show is not only the New Year's Eve show, but it was like, in the span of 4 days, I was thinking, I just saw three real great Bruce Springsteen shows. That was something to see. You know, I think I had seen him a few times already, but never three times in four nights. So that was like Bruce overload. And it was like, here I go into 1981. Yeah.
I think back on it sometimes because I was aware of these shows. I did know the music. I had the River by that point. Of course, on the island, it was a big deal that he was playing these shows. If I had actually gotten the chance to go, if I would have understood what I was seeing, I imagine I would have been blown away. But you think of yourself at that age, seeing and experiencing something like that, it's hard to figure. But, you know, it wasn't meant to be then. Fortunately, a couple of years later, it was meant to be. And here we are.
Yeah. I'm glad they had the recording truck there, though, to get these shows out because, you know, as you said, not only New Year's Eve, the 29th is a pretty damn good show, too.
Well, all three shows that have circulated as soundboards going back to almost back to the time, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I mean, that is true.
I think I heard some conspiracy theories that they was leaked to a DJ in England just to get some hype going for the shows in Europe in the summer of 81. I don't know how true that is, but it's, you know, it's a theory.
Well, it just goes to show you, because even after the River Tour, they still didn't release a live album. They were sitting on these shows, and someone said, well, it was Bruce. We know not someone. It was Bruce said, you know what? I don't want to release a live album. It's really remarkable that you, if you think about it.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, the other thing, New Year's Eve, Auld Lang Syne, that's a rocking version. You listen to that. I mean, Clarence's sax and Danny's organ. I mean, they're rocking on that. That's a great version.
Yeah, they had some fun with that one. They made it a rock song, as you said.
Well, you really have to ask, did any band at any time really ever play any better than they were playing in this stretch of shows late December 1980?
No, you know, I think they were feeling the confidence, too, that, you know, they're about ready to take off. And, you know, I wrote down this note from listening to the show again. Bruce said, I ain't no bum. Me and you are going to make it in 1981. And they sure did. And they took off. Absolutely.
Now, but before we wrap up, did you see shows in the summer of 81 as well?
I saw the second night at the Meadowlands, which would have been, July 3rd, 1981, when the arena just opened up. And tell you the truth, I thought Bruce was very tight then. I don't know what it just, I remember he just didn't talk to the crowd that much. And I know some of the other shows of the six were better, but yeah, I didn't walk away that night feeling like, every Bruce show was a great show, but I didn't walk away that night thinking that that night was anywhere near what I saw here at the Nassau Coliseum over the three nights.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. He'd been through so much by then because he had had the exhaustion. He went to Europe, which was really the first time they experienced a huge European tour. There were only a few dates there in 75. And then he came back and he opened the Meadowlands. And the shows, just listening to it, of course, I wasn't there, but listening to it, the shows do feel very different than what he played here in late 1980.
Yeah, you know, he was much looser at the end of 1980, and yeah, that's what I remember at the Meadowlands. Like I said, it was only at one show, but he just seemed real tight, like not you know, as having as much fun as he did during the end of 1980.
Well, there's definitely a debate about which stretch of shows were better, whether it was the freewheeling marathons of the fall and winter of 1980, or the more tight, succinct, you know, almost political shows that he did in the summer of 81.
Right.
Well, it goes back to that awakening I was talking about that he was having that really started right around this time.
Right. But at the same time, you can have an awakening and still have a freewheeling show, right?
Yeah, I guess so. You are right. The show did become a lot more compact in 1981. And also, I think, and there's been a lot of discussion about this, we probably should take an even closer look at it at some point. In the summer of 81, a lot of the songs were played at slower tempos, right?
Yes. Especially like the Hungry Hearts and Cadillac Ranches of the world.
Yeah, so it really, and I don't know that we'll ever get the answer to why that happened. It does seem unusual within the same tour for a band to really change the tempos of some of the songs.
Especially since those shows ended up being a little bit shorter than when the songs were faster paced.
That's a good point. So, Stan, anything else you want to say about these shows before we wrap up?
No, just quite the memories. Thanks for bringing them back. You know, after 40 years, you forget some things. So, but looking back, you know, the funny thing is, I have no idea how I got tickets. I remember, like I said, the New Year's Eve show, I got the tickets in the mail order. I still have no idea I got the tickets to the 28th or the 29th. So, but somehow I was there all three nights, and they were magical nights. I always look back and proud that I was there, and You know, I'm not one to brag as some, but I just, you know, it's always proud to say I was at that New Year's Eve show in 1980, as it was a legendary one.
Yes, it was. Yeah, that's certainly, I think that gives you some bragging rights there.
Oh, yeah.
My wife certainly does not hesitate to brag about that whenever it comes up.
Yeah, it was fun. It just stuns me. 40 years. Like, I think 40 years from 1980 was 1940.
Yeah.
So. No, it just blows your mind. Yes. I mean,
it's true.
It's hard to comprehend. It'd really be interesting to know how Bruce feels now, now that he's 71, and to think back and look at the band. Well, I don't think they have much film of the band at this point, but to listen to the band and these multi-tracks, I wonder what he thinks when he hears it, because he's got to be like, man, we were really fucking good.
He should think that anyway, but I think that we got all the video or all the film they have in the River box set.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. So, well, Stan, thank you so much for sharing your memories of these shows with us and with our audience.
Yes, thank you.
Crazy, as we said, 40 years, and I'm certainly going to pull out these shows and listen to them on the anniversary next week.
Ditto.
Yeah, thank you for having me, and wonderful memories. And I did listen to the New Year's Eve show. Matter of fact, it was on E Street Radio today, and I was listening to it. And I think I'm going to pull out the December 29th show in a few days again, too, and take a listen to that. Thank you for having me on. I enjoy your podcast. I listen to everyone, and they're great. You two really know your stuff. So it's
thank you very much, Stan. That means a lot. And hopefully we'll be able to see you out on the road sometime soon.
All right. Thank you.
So that was Stan Goldstein. And again, we thank him for joining us. To give us a little bit more flavor about these shows, specifically the middle one, 1229, we have another guest joining us now, Flynn.
And now we're going to talk with another good friend of ours, Lowell Kern. We've known him going back to the 90s, and he's seen a lot of shows in the New York area. So welcome, Lowell, to the podcast.
Happy to be here.
And so you were at the middle show, the December 29th show.
Right. There were the three shows at Nassau. At that point in time, I was getting my tickets through my dad, quite frankly. he was a dentist. He had a lot of CBS execs who were patients. And after seeing one of the Garden shows over Thanksgiving weekend, I'm like, I got to go to Nassau. And I asked, and they said, yeah, but you can't get New Year's Eve. So I settled for the 29th.
Well, wasn't a bad show to settle for, at least, no. Especially in retrospect.
Definitely not. Listening to the archive release, as we were saying with Stan, I mean, it's almost, if it's not the equal of 1231, it's right up there.
It was a great, great show. I mean, but I was still a relative newbie at the time, and I didn't realize you didn't get Incident into Rosie all the time. You know, I had seen the show I saw Thanksgiving weekend at the Garden was my first full-length Bruce show. The first time I saw him was No Nukes, but that was my first full-length Bruce show. So the 1229 show was only my second full-length show. And, you know, I didn't really appreciate then what I do now looking back at that show.
I can imagine.
In addition to Incident, or what other aspects do you feel like you appreciate more now than then?
I just you know, the whole, it was different pre-Born in the USA. The vibe was different. It was, I mean, I know a lot of the world thinks we're a cult.
Well, let's not use that word.
It was really cult-like back then, especially in the New York area. Because it was our thing. I mean, I was in high school at the time, and the Who had toured, and then there was the, you know, the Zeppelin tour that was canceled, and there was all of that buzz about those kind of shows, but Bruce was something else.
Can you describe the vibe at all for those of us who were not there pre-Born in the USA?
It was... And the first couple of shows, I mean, you've got to tie the seven New York area shows together.
Right.
Because it was, the first two were obviously Thanksgiving weekend. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people came, you know, it was high school. People came into school on Monday. Everyone was wearing the River Tour baseball jersey that I will admit I lived in until it was threadbare.
Well, do you still have it?
I still have it, but it's not in good shape. I had to buy a second one after, off of eBay just to make my quilt.
Yeah, we have a quilt too.
Yeah.
No so, quilt here.
You know, there was when you got into school on Monday, it was like, because you didn't know everyone who was there. It was a holiday weekend. You didn't necessarily know who was going the way I would now know, you know, 150 people who are all going to be at the show. So you kind of looked at everyone. And it's like, oh, my God, that was amazing. You know, and there was just kind of this, it was kind of like an inside joke in a little bit of a way that, you know, all right, what I just saw, no one else will understand. So there was also, I had a good friend who didn't see one of those shows, but he was going to one of the December, what was it, the 18th and 19th shows.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there was, you know, there was a tinge of, you know, envy that you saw it already and I haven't seen it. And this was the guy who gave me my first couple of bootlegs. So I had one up on him. And then you got to the shows over what was, you know, again, high school Christmas break at Nassau. It was, all right, well, what do you mean you're going again? You know, and it,
well, now who said that to you? Other people, other friends,
parents,
parents. Yeah, that's what I thought.
Well, my parents, absolutely. My father's like, why do you want to go again? I'm like, Dad, just trust me. He's like, okay, I'll ask. Thank you to Bunny Freitas, wherever she is. it's, you know, the people who didn't get it are, why are you going again? And the people who got it are like, I can't believe you got tickets to go again.
That's one of the things we were talking about with Stan, was that at this point, Bruce was, he hadn't broken out yet fully. He was big in the New York area. He was big in some other areas. But as you note, it was pre-born in the USA, and it was a different scene. Probably some of our listeners who come along much after Born in the USA don't understand at this point that Bruce was not really, he was certainly not a superstar, right?
Not on the kind of level where he's, you know, inherited Dylan's role as voice of a generation. He was a New York, New Jersey cult figure. Yeah, Boston, Philly, Phoenix, L.A. But it was. I know you said not to use the word Hal, but we were our, you know, there were people in the know, and then there were people who just didn't get it. You know, high school, again, think back, you know, everyone's wearing whatever concert t-shirts they wore, you know, whatever they'd go to the show, they'd buy, you know, mostly, especially at the Garden, the bootleg shirts on the way back to the Long Island Railroad. And that's how you know what everyone saw, because it's what shirt were they wearing the next day?
Yeah, that was what killed me, because I was in middle school at the time, and you know, you saw all the older kids and they were all wearing these Springsteen shirts, and I knew the shows had taken place, as I said earlier in the episode, and it was just a killer because it was my awakening. I had just discovered Bruce earlier that year, or really the year before, and I knew the shows were happening and they were 10 minutes from my house, but you know, I just couldn't go. That was the reality. I was 12 years old and my parents weren't letting me go to any rock concerts, much less on New Year's Eve or anything like that. So it was sort of like this unobtainable thing that you knew about, and I couldn't wait until I could obtain it. And obviously that happened a few years later.
Yeah, and Hal, they would have had to drive you to the Coliseum because there was no way to get there.
Yeah, that was a problem with Islander games as well.
Yep. I it was funny because it was my birth. You had to be 17 in Nassau County to get a driver's license. I realize most of the country doesn't know that. It's 16 most everywhere. You had to be 17, and I was 2 weeks shy of my 17th birthday. So I had to ask a friend who had her driver's license already just so I could get out there to get to Nassau. And it was, you know, the Garden was so much easier. Everyone went, you know, where I grew up on Long Island, it was 28 minutes to Penn Station on the railroad. So everyone would go to the shows at the Garden. Nassau was more difficult. And the Nassau shows, like I started to say before, were over Christmas break. So again, you didn't know who was going to be there, if you were going to run into anyone you know. But when people found out you were going again, it was, there was this kind of, you know, inside thing to it, you know, like, oh, you know, you get it, which was really pretty cool, which you didn't, it didn't feel the same way after the USA tour when the entire world got it.
So tell us a little about the night. Like, what do you remember when the band came out on stage? And obviously this is one of their peaks, if not the ultimate peak of Bruce and the E Street Band's performing career. What do you remember about the show and the energy that was in the building?
Oh, it was insane. I mean, you mentioned the Islander games. That was, you know, the Islander glory days, you know, the four cups. It was louder than winning a Stanley Cup. The energy in the building was just off the charts in a way that, I apologize for all the dings, that was off the charts in a way that it never felt exactly the same again. Maybe when Steve came out on, you know, in the last show at the Meadowlands in 84. That was the noise, the energy, the vibe. Again, I was a newbie at the time. I had seen the Garden show. I knew kind of what to expect. This was, you know, way before the days of, you know, forget the Backstreet's Hotline. It may have been, you know, before Backstreet's. No, I know they were out there in 78. Sorry, Charlie.
No, the first issue of Backstreet's was October of 80.
Yeah. Was it really?
Yeah.
All right. So there was no Backstreet's Hotline to call in and get set lists. So I knew what I had seen, and I was, and the shows, the length of the shows, not time-wise, but the number of songs, you were talking, you know, high 20s, low 30s at that point in time, which was unheard of. You know, it's still unheard of for anyone except Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band. But it at that point in time, it the shows went on forever. I mean, I remember it, I know we're supposed to be talking about Nassau, but like I said, I think of those group of shows together. I remember the Garden show, the friend I was with, we're like, are we going to get the train back to Great Neck, or, you know, are we going to be sitting in Penn Station for 2 hours? Because this show's never going to end. And it kind of felt that way at Nassau too. I mean, I don't remember how many songs they played that night, but my memory of it is that the shows just went on forever in a way, because I didn't know what was coming. It's like when you go to the first show of a tour and you don't know what's coming and you don't know how long he's going to play for. You know, we get the rehearsal information now, so it's not as total shock, but you know, you had no idea what was coming next. At least I didn't, you know.
I believe the count was 35, by the way.
Yeah, okay. It's
on 1229.
Mind-boggling.
No, these were just epic performances. Certainly the archive releases reveal that, and just to have been in these buildings for the entire year of 1980, just anyone who was there was so fortunate. And it, obviously there's nothing we can do about age, but it bums me out to know, as I've said before, that you know, these shows were taking place so close to home, and damn, I missed it. But it's great that 40 years later, we can relive it with you and with Stan and with the archives, of course.
Yeah, no, you always wanted to be somewhere else. You know, Hal, you wanted to be at Nassau. You know, how many of us wanted to be at the Bottom Line that were 11 years old at the time and weren't getting into the Bottom Line, even if we knew about the Bottom Line?
That's true. And yeah, this was.
I remember, again, I don't remember the show as specifically as I could tell you about anything in the reunion era. But right. Remember the vibe. I remember the feel. I remember when they did the mail order the next spring for the opening of the Brendan Byrne Arena. And the insanity that went on around that, because at that point, if you didn't know who the Bruce fans were, you knew by then, because, you know, 6 months later.
Everyone wore their T-shirts every day for 6 months.
Exactly. I mean, part of the reason that shirt is threadbare is because I'd wear it on Monday, you know, I'd wash it midweek, and I'd wear it again on Friday. And it, you know, everyone knew, and that the, you know, the energy of going to the post office for that silly mail order was just, again, it was something that I'll always remember. And no matter how many shows I go to, how many, you know, outstanding, amazing performances we see, whether one-off songs or, you know, amazing shows, you know, that come out of the middle of nowhere, there was an energy there. And maybe it's just because I was a newbie, and maybe it's because I didn't really appreciate what I was getting. But it's part of what sucked me into all of this was, I mean, it rivaled, you know, to stay with the Nassau vibe, it rivaled winning a Stanley Cup.
Yeah, well,
4 years in a row.
Well, yes, 4 years in a row. We won't talk about what's taken place since, but that was pretty damn awesome when we were winning.
But that, it was like that every night. You'd walk into the building in that vibe, and I know some people still feel it now, walking into a building. You know, I don't necessarily feel the same way walking into the building now that I did, Jesus, 40 years ago.
Well, you're also not 16.
Don't remind me.
Well, it's funny because I do often feel the same when I walk into a building, just the energy of being in the building. You know, it's hard for me to connect because obviously it has been so long, but I do feel like when we walk in these days and the show is about to start and the lights go down, I'm still electrified by it. Are you saying you're just not electrified to the same level that you were, or you're a little bit more like it doesn't mean as much to you today?
Oh, no, it means just as much. But I realize that most of the crowd is probably still feeling that way. But I mean, and I hate to sound like a jerk here, but I've done it so many times. You know, I know when they start climbing up to the rack, to the lighting rig over the pit, it's 8 o'clock and he's coming on in 20 minutes, which I didn't necessarily know when I was 16. You know, you get in now, you look at the stage and you count the mic stands. Okay, Patty's not here.
Right. Well, you know, that is true.
You know, you can do that kind of thing now because we have this kind of body of knowledge. I had no clue what I was walking into. I didn't know what he was going to open with most nights. Are you getting Born to Run? Are you getting Badlands? Are you, you know, I guess it was Badlands most of the time, but.
Well, 1229 opened with Night, which was toward their debut.
I don't remember exactly the show specifically, but you didn't know. You didn't know what was coming. It was that anything can happen vibe that still shows up from time to time, but it was every show, it was every night. And again, maybe it's because I'm 40 years older and I've been doing this for too long, but it was the energy and that anything can happen vibe is what I remember most about those shows.
Well, that's very, very cool. And we thank you very much for coming on to talk about this and reminisce with us 40 years ago on these shows. Can I ask you a more current question just while we have you?
Sure, Hal. Go ahead.
What's your favorite song off Letter to You?
What day of the week is it? Same as any other album. Priest is awesome, and I can listen to that over and over again, but that's partly because of knowing where it came from. I like those middle three that are poo-pooing that I really think are the heart of the show. I really think, you know, 1,000 Guitars is really what it's all about. And I know the song was written pre-pandemic, but if you listen to it in knowing where we've been, it's almost a plea for us to get back together and go to a show again.
Yeah, it's a healing song.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. And I love that about the record because I've always loved that about Bruce's writing.
And then you had said to me that Last Man Standing is about his first show.
Yeah, well, I think you've got that there's a little bit of an arc in there. Last Man Standing, because you're talking about, you know, George Thies and, you know, the Castiles. And then you get Power of Prayer, which, you know, is after some show in some club somewhere, and then you get 1,000 Guitars, and it's the next show. So you've got his whole career right there in three songs.
And then that all culminates with Ghost, which is my favorite song off the record. I was switching from day to day, but now I can say it is solidly Ghosts, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that brings it all, you know, around again, because it's, you know, if we're here and you're here, then they're here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It goes back to that again.
Well, just like we count the living as we count off time.
Yep.
Or count off the missing as we count off time.
And hopefully we will all be there again soon. So
as soon as we can.
In the house of 1,000 Guitars.
It's something I know we're dreaming of, and a lot of the people who are listening are dreaming, and not just for Bruce. I mean, all music in general. And hopefully, as I said, we'll all be back soon, and we'll all be in the same arena seeing Bruce and E Street Band, and he'll count off, and
away we go.
This will all be forgotten,
and all this darkness passed.
Yes,
for at least 4 hours.
That's what he's there for.
Yep, that's what I tell you.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, guys. It's been a
pleasure. Are welcome.
And again, that was our good buddy Lowell Kern joining us to talk about the Coliseum. That was a lot of fun, Flynn. What did you think?
Yes, it was. It's always good to hear firsthand recollections of these classic shows that, as we mentioned before, we were just too darn young to even imagine attending.
Yes. So fun night, and everyone should check out the archives if they don't own them already. Pick them up, and these are definitely shows you want to listen to, and let's honor that 40th anniversary when Bruce and E Street Band were on the very, very top of their game.
Yes, and I'm sure E Street Radio will be playing them this week as well. So if they don't have them, they can just turn on Sirius if they have that.
I think that's a safe bet. And with that, I think that brings our look at the Coliseum shows to an end. It also brings 2020 to an end, thank God.
Yeah, let's turn the page here.
We want to wish everyone a very happy and healthy new year. Better things ahead in 2021.
Yeah, and of course, on the Bruce front, you know, is it too early to start hoping for tracks 2 at the end of the year?
Probably,
but I'm obsessed or anything.
We're gonna do that anyway. We're certainly gonna hope for that.
Okay.
None But the Brave is a presentation of Bull Market Entertainment. Please subscribe on your podcast platform of choice. We're on Apple Podcast, Amazon Music, Google. We're on all of them pretty much. And if you want to interact with us online, you can find us on Twitter at NBTB Podcast. And our website is nonebutthebravepodcast.com.
Yes. Once again, I want to thank our guest, Stan Goldstein and Lowell Kern. And for Hal Schwartz, I'm Flynn McLean saying, we'll see you further on up the road.
Thank you so much. We'll be seeing you.
Hi, this is Chad Nicefield.
And this is Justin Press.
We're the host of Making Waves, the Shiprock podcast, a part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. We're inviting you to sail away with us on an epic journey in musical enlightenment. Every week, we bring you only the best artists in rock music and discuss everything from the cruise to the stage to the saga of being a professional recording artist. We'll have lots of special guests along the way, so tune in every week.
Your stateroom is available every Monday morning, so welcome aboard.